So it's kind of reminded me a little bit of Shawshank when the older guy gets out at the end and he's just like, there's fucking cars. I saw one car when I was a child before I went to prison, and like the world's fucking crazy now. So we don't know how long they've been in, but it can't be, they're younger.
He kills him. He kills himself, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he did. Yeah. You remember Shawshank.
I remember.
The cars drove him to it. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of I Finally Watched. This is David.
And this is Alon, and I finally watched Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
So I think this might be my first Coen's Brothers movie that I saw at the point where I wasn't even like interested in who directed movies.
Right.
Like that's not how I decided to watch something, which is kind of funny to think about now that I was just like blindly like, oh, the cover of that looks good, or that trailer looks good. It was like 13 or 14 at the time when this came out. So, I also don't know that before today I had ever seen the movie all the way from start to finish, like put it on to watch it. This was one that was on cable all the time and would just randomly like pick up bits here and there. I may have even seen the end before I saw the rest of it.
You know, both you and Taylor say that this movie has been on cable all the time. One, I wonder why. And two, why don't I know that?
I don't know.
When did this movie came out? Like 2009? 2000? 2000. Okay, so
we were close.
I guess I was just like on a like into different movies in 2000.
What kind of movies was Alon into
when I was eight?
Yeah,
in the probably year fucking animated Disney movies when I was 8 years old.
Yeah, I mean, so I think one of the reasons this was such a big deal is because of George Clooney. I think this character for him was like something kind of, even to this day, sort of a very different thing. It actually, I guess, reminds me most of his character in Burn After Reading. Like they're different, but sort of how it's like this air of like he's got it all together, but in the back he's really just kind of an idiot.
There's that, but also he's still like the coolest main character out of the three. Like he's still the most suave, the most charming, the most put together, because it's like, okay, it's George Clooney, you know.
Yeah, so I mean, before this, From Dusk Till Dawn, Batman and Robin, he's playing Bruce Wayne, Out of Sight, Three Kings, these are all really just cool characters that sort of are in line with what you think of George Clooney. And so this is like very interesting. It's also, this being like my first Coen Brothers movie is sort of a weird entrant into like implanting in my brain what I think a Coen Brothers movie is.
See, I was thinking about this when I was watching it, is that when you have a movie directed by a certain director, you kind of can clump most of their movies in being like, of course that's a Spielberg. Of course that's a Michael Bay. But I think Coen Brothers has some of the most like eclectic, like just different movies from one another. I don't know why. It's not in the tonality of it. It's just they're all so different. Maybe they're quite similar within the dialogue of each character and how they interact with each other. But even when you watch a Tarantino movie, you know it's a fucking Tarantino movie. But a Coen Brothers movie, blindly watching it, it's like, I don't know.
I think it's kind of the genres that they mix in, right? So like Tarantino's are all sort of dramatic, a lot of action, some violence, and then like super funny and dialogue heavy. He's sort of like every single one of his movies sort of goes through all of those genres, right?
That's true.
Scorsese, like, doesn't really dip his toes into comedy except for, like, Wolf of Wall Street. But even that is kind of, like, super sort of dramatic. And Goodfellas is funny in spots, too.
Well, you could even say, like, the Departed in spots is kind of comedic.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's very true. But my point is the Coen brother thing. I think one of their main reasons that they're kind of so, like, they have such a spectrum of movies is they'll do something like this, which is almost slapstick, like a Three Stooges movie, all the way to an Inside Llewyn Davis or a No Country for Old Men at the very, like, outside of that. Right.
See, that's what I'm thinking is, like, you compare three movies. You compare Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, No Country for Old Men, and Fargo. And you're like, that can't be directed by the same person.
You know, Woody Allen has a little bit of this, except they're still all just, like, so kind of, like, idiosyncratic.
I don't,
like,
watch Woody Allen movies.
That's fine.
I've grown from that.
Okay, anyway. Thank you for interrupting me. I don't either virtue signal or make a joke. I don't know what you were doing. Both. But covering all the bases at once.
Yeah, I'm safe.
But for example, like, he'll do, like, very strictly comedies and he'll do very strictly super dramatic movies. But at the end of the day, you can sort of tell that that is a Woody Allen movie. So I'm in saying all this and going through all these directors that I like, agreeing with you that even though I think a lot of their movies kind of are very similar. So, you know, you have this Big Lebowski, Miller's Crossing, are all ones that are, like, kind of similar tonality. I got caught in the middle right there, but they have a lot that are very similar, but they do also, like, the edges are can be so different in a Coen Brothers movie.
The thing is too is now I'm thinking about the first Coen Brother movies that I watched, and I'm thinking, well, look, here's the thing, right? It's like the Big Lebowski is probably the one I sat down and watched first without even knowing it's a Coen Brothers movie. But at the same time, I'm curious if it was Fargo. But at the same time, it might have been True Grit. Because I could have just went to the theater with my dad to go see True Grit and then think, oh, cool, right? It's Western, whatever movie. But a movie that I, like, specifically sought out once I actually knew who the Coen brothers were, I was like, oh man, as soon as this movie hits theaters, I want to go see it. And that was Hail Caesar.
Yeah, I came to that one super late. I think probably pandemic, and really liked that one a lot. And that one is kind of completely sort of different. I don't know. I mean, they definitely have, like, modes where they're, like, they're doing, like, this or that, right? Like, Inside Llewyn Davis and Fargo's kind of an interesting case too, where it's, like, super serious, but then, like, this very dry humor that, like, can get you.
I think maybe what it is, the connecting factor, you know, through all the Coen brothers movie is the characters. And how they're drawn from, like, really grounded, real characters. And they take maybe the funniest aspects of these grounded characters and highlight those attributes.
The start of this movie, I love the just sort of, you know, this is basically a take on the Odyssey, right? And some movies would not lean into it as much as this one does. Like, it has, like, the opening the opening dialogue on the screen, just, like, you know, from, you know, straight from the Odyssey. And then just, I think it even says, like, this is, you know, our version of the Odyssey in there. And it's interesting. I haven't read the Odyssey since high school when I was forced to. And I probably just, like, watched a movie of it. It was fun to, like, try and remember things from that. And then,
yeah, it was kind of like it
to the movie.
Yeah. Like, connecting the characters from the Odyssey and to be like, okay, so who's this character? Kind of like, when you have John Goodman and you're like, obviously it's the Cyclops, and you have the sirens and the river. Those are, like, the obvious ones. But then you're like the politicians, like, connecting those. And that's interesting to me.
Well, it's funny too, is, like, I remembered the Cyclops, especially, like, the movie version I watched, And when he like hits them and gets away, I was like, that's not what I remember happening at all. So when he gets his comeuppance later, I was like, oh, that's nice.
He catches the flag. I was like, oh my God.
John Goodman always plays like either a character you really like or a character you just like can't fucking stand and you like want something bad to happen to them.
The character in the Coen Brothers movie that John Goodman plays that just always really sticks out to me is his character in Inside Llewyn Davis.
Yeah.
Where he's like this handicapped, obese guy, and the bathroom scene is like, and he just leaves him there. And I'm just like, oh my God.
Well, and him in the back of the car getting angry.
Yeah, but that's why he leaves them in the bathroom, like struggling. And I'm just like, so good. So good.
I need to watch that movie again. So this also, I think, has got to be maybe one of their most slapstick movies. And it kind of starts in the beginning, right? So like we see them continually bouncing up as they're running away. And I was like, why don't you just guys like just crawl away the whole time? But like jumping up, jumping back down as like the guards turn and then making it out. And then when they get to the train and the moment where he gets on there and he's like, are you any of you proficient in the metallurgical arts? As like he gets pulled off the train is like very funny to me.
But then the faces they make, and I gotta say, like John Turturro and Blake Nelson are like some of the best actors you could possibly get to just look stupid the whole time.
They're actually like very perfect for this.
And the faces that they were making when they were getting pulled off the train, even Clooney was just like the most dumbest, bewildered face.
This, yeah, it's for such like a non-Clooney part. I think he's like actually like kind of perfect in that role. I would say Burn After Reading is the most un-Clooney part I feel like he's done.
Dude, Burn After Reading kind of takes all those actors in there and puts them in like reversal roles. Like Brad Pitt comes to mind, right? And all of them, really, it's just these role. Brad Pitt in Burn After Reading reminds me of Tom Cruise in Magnolia. It's just such a weird, like, out of body experience.
We need to find a way to do Burn After Reading because I've never had such a 180 on a movie where I fucking hated that movie. And then as years go by, because I think I saw that probably like before I was really like, oh, I kind of like the Coen brothers, right? So that came out after No Country. And when I saw Burn After Reading, I'm not even sure if I knew it was their movie, right? Like that I was tracking that, although I probably should have. And I went into the theater. I probably did know it was them. And so I have expectations after seeing No Country of like what this movie's going to be.
Oh, see, that's the problem.
So going into it, I'm just like, what the fuck is happening here? This is so insane.
One of the movies that I went to go see that I absolutely hated was Men Who Stare at Goats. And which, yeah, ironically, is also Clooney. And I always compare The Men Who Stare at Goats with Burn After Reading. I don't know if it's because of Clooney. I don't know if they came out around the same time.
I feel like they did.
They did. They actually came out,
I think, like a year apart. I think Goats was 2009.
Yeah, and After Reading was 2008. And so I actually always thought the Goats were also Coen Brothers. But
they were not.
I digress. So the only way I would do Burn After Reading with you, David, on the podcast is if, one, two conditions must apply here. One, we get someone who's never seen it, and then we can have them as a guest and do it. Or we use it as a slot in one of our December We've Already Seen It movies. But the second condition is we have to pair it with Men Who Stare at Goats.
We'll just have to do an extra episode because I don't think I want to use either of those conditions.
Or since we've introduced bonus episodes, we could always do a bonus episode about both.
Quit going behind the podcast. So next, a blind oracle shows up, which is kind of the first like big like sort of connection to, you know, mythology. And he basically just sort of spells out the rest of the movie. Like, you guys are going after treasure. You will not get it. And So it's really funny because then Clooney's like talking up, oh, well, you know, people that lose their sense of sight, you know, they are given other advantages in other areas. So, you know, he probably has some clairvoyance about him. And then they're like, well, he said we're not going to get the treasure. He's like, well, what do you trust a blind guy for anyway? Like, he doesn't know.
And then it's revealed that there was never any treasure and Clooney lied about the whole thing. So he knew that the Oracle was right.
I mean, the treasure was really the journey and the friends they made along the way.
They didn't really make any friends along the way. They made a bunch of enemies.
Once the pardon happened, they were sort of all chummy. So they go to a cousin of
John Turturro,
whose name is Pete, I believe. I was realizing pretty late into watching this movie, I was like, I don't fucking know anybody's name. I can't just be calling him like the deal with the devil guy. And I know Delmar because they kept saying his name. And then Ulysses Everett McGill. Go to a cousin to get out of the chains. His wife is a RUNNOFT, which is I love the continual callback to like spelling out runoffed as one word. And then the kid like being able to spell it immediately. And then what Delmar saying it later. But the cousin sells them out. They're in the barn. And I think that, you know, there isn't like a character arc in this movie. There's not like a very complex
there
mystery.
There kind of is.
Let me finish. I disagree with you. But this is a very kind of like simple, like slice of life story that is, you know, mimicking the Odyssey. And so it is kind of interesting. Like, I feel like probably some people would see this as like a slighter Coen Brothers movie. But to me, it was just kind of enjoyable. But I love the, like, as they're, like, the cops are burning down the barn. And this is the point I wanted to make is, like, the movie establishes in the first time we meet these, like, cops that are after them, like, these are just pure evil, right? Like, you have the guy with the blacked out glasses who basically looks as if he has no eyes.
I'm confused about that, and I want to get to that more. But let's go back to the cousins, right? The hog wallop. And I love Pete, John Turturro's character, who's like, never trust a hog wallop. And they shouldn't, right? Because he actually... And I love the fact that they're in the barn, the authorities come to arrest them, and George Clooney knows exactly what's up, right? He's like, your cousin sold us out to the cops. And it's here's like the comedic beats that are all throughout this movie. He goes, my cousin would never throw us under the bus. How dare you? He's blood. How dare you even like think that? And then you hear Hog Wallop's voice down by where the cops are. He's like, I'm sorry, cousin, I had to throw you under the bus. I had to sell you out to the authorities. And then Pete is like, you no good mother, you know? And that is kind of like where the comedy is that kind of timing and reverse, you know, dialogue.
Yeah. And so then the son like breaks in with the car, and he, this is like the spelling, the runoff thing, and they get out of there. I do love too him throwing the fire back
and blows and, like, up the truck. Yeah.
I kind of remembered it / I was like, when the fire got thrown up there, I was like, oh, grab it and throw it back. And then he does it. And I was like, did I remember that? Or it's just like, I don't know, but, throws it back, and the cop's like, oh fuck, my car's going to explode. There's just like a ton of like flammable liquid in there, and then a Tommy gun goes off,
and ammunition, like, and like all the things that I don't know why they brought all that, but yeah, so they get out there and then they steal the car from the kid
and they're like, go back home, like, don't stay with us. And he's like, you guys sold me out, I saved your lives. And so they next like realize their car is broken down, and so it's going to take 2 weeks to get a new belt. And I love the, after they realize like, well, here, we'll just sell this. And Pete's like, what the fuck is this? He's like, oh, it's your cousin's watch. He's like, you stole my cousin's watch. He's like, well, he sold us out. He's like, you didn't know he sold us out when you stole the watch. He's like, I was saving it for if he did. He's like, that doesn't make any sense. And then as this is happening, you just have like these people in white walking by that they slowly like keep noticing more and more. And also a little funny bit in that is fucking Delmar just continually offering him gopher, like will not let it go. Like, do you want some gopher? Do you want some gopher? How about gopher? Anybody gopher?
I don't know when George Clooney took a step aside, because he's like, no, you have the gopher. He's like, Pete and I already had each of our own. This is the third gopher. I was like, so I guess Clooney did not go gopher hunting with them. The baptism scene is so just like, here's what I was going to say about the whole film and how it kind of feels like a stage play. Because each scene feels like their own contained thing. And when you move on from one scene to another, it's like, it's a hard cut. Do you see what I mean? Like nothing really runs together until the end. The end, everything kind of, you know, it feels more of a like a movie when you get to the end of the film. But up till that point, it feels like a play where it's like act one, scene one, act one, scene two, act. And that's kind of how the Greeks did it too, right? With their, like, how they...
Yeah, yeah, I think that's a very purposeful way of doing it, right? Yeah, so I agree. And also sort of in line with, like, the Ballad of Buster Scruggs and, like, kind of, you know that they have that in there.
Which I was not a fan of.
I don't know. I think anthologies are hard. I think theirs is kind of one of the better ones. Like, you know, just having a bunch of short stories, right? Like... they sort of stuck with me, like the guy who's panhandling for gold and the guy tries to kill him. Like, I like that one.
I just remembered Franco being hung, being like, first time.
Yeah, the meme of that. The other one with the guy with no arms and no legs that Liam Neeson is carrying around, that one was really fucking harsh to me. Like,
oh man, I need to watch it again. Maybe I'll have more like respect for it. I remember when he comes into the bar and then he has to put his gun on the counter, right? And then he sits down and plays poker with the other ruffians. And he wins. And they don't like that. So they pull a gun on him. And he's like, I thought we were supposed to leave those at the door. And he hits the table and makes them shoot himself in the face. That's the other one I remember.
But yeah. I mean, so, I don't know. Short movies all contained together, I think, is a hard thing to do. And I think... I don't know. It's one of the more successful ones to me of ones I've seen that like...
It was nominated for an Academy.
Academy Award? Award?
An award.
You shortened Academy Award to... It was nominated for an Academy.
You know what I fucking meant.
So as Clooney's basically saying like, oh, anyone who's stupid enough to go get baptized, and then Tim Blake Nelson and then John Turturro like run in there one after the other. It is... If there is any arc... And I don't even necessarily see it as an arc, but Clooney's very antagonistic towards religion. And then sort of at the end, when push comes to shove, he starts praying. Like there at least.
But then he takes it all back.
He takes it all back. But John Turturro points out like, oh, you were singing a different tune when we were at the gallows. And he, you know, he has a line because he's a smooth talker. But, you know, it is sort of a little bit of an interesting like twist on his character. It's funny, like right after the baptism, I think they just. They just have a car, so I guess we're just supposed to assume that they sold that watch or whatever, but the next scene just cuts. As you said, the stage play nature, they're just in a new car.
Well, also, we see them steal a car a little bit down the way where, like, a guy walks out of it at a gas station. They're walking out of the gas station store into his car and just drive away with it, because I guess no one back then really locks anything. So maybe that's giving us a hint on how they get all of their transportation.
Yeah, well, I mean, they did say, like, hey, sell the watch and we can get a car. And they run across Tommy, who is black. And so it was the baptism almost explains, like, normally I don't think these three white guys would pull over to pick up a black guy. But because of, like, oh, we've just been saved and redeemed, they're, like, feeling extra, like, nice. And they're like, oh, let's pull over and help this guy out. It's also, there's this funny part in the movie, and I guess it's just because they're dirty that everyone keeps calling them black.
So it's during the KKK rally, and it's because John Turturro just escaped from prison a second time. So he has that like railway dust all over his face, which makes him look darker. But have you noticed that Clooney, this entire movie, has been sporting like a really good tan?
Really good. I mean, really dark. I don't know if it was really good. He's like, definitely like he just got from the coast.
Like Matthew McConaughey at the 2024 Oscars tan.
Was he really tan? I didn't notice.
No, you didn't notice. It was called out.
Anyway, so they talk with Tommy. He was at those crossroads because he sold his soul to the devil last night. So he would teach him how to play the guitar. And he said, yep. The devil is white as you, black eyes. And this is where you're wanting to talk about the sheriff that is after them, right?
This is the part I was a little confused about, because he describes the sheriff in this moment as he's talking about what the devil looks like. And when you see the sheriff, it's exactly as Tommy describes him. White guy, dark eyes with the sunglasses, the hound, and the bellowing voice. And I was just like, is that the devil? Are we supposed to think that's the devil? First of all, Tommy doesn't say anything when he comes face to face with him. And also, he doesn't really seem like the type of guy to give you guitar lessons.
To a black guy?
To anyone.
Well, I mean, the dude's certainly racist, right? Because he's going to hang those three guys, and then he's only hanging Tommy, too, at the end, because he's a black guy that happens to be there, right?
I don't know, man. I think everyone's racist in that time.
You don't want to...
I think everyone's racist.
It was just a cool thing to be in the 30s in the South.
Of course.
So I think the movie is... I don't think the movie is saying that this sheriff was the devil there that night. I think it's sort of just pointing out that the devil looks an awful lot like this guy who is chasing after them, sort of casting like aspersions as to who this sheriff is. He's like evil incarnate and he's after you.
I do enjoy that every step of the way the authorities are hot on their trail. They're always like this background antagonist that keeps pushing them to like the next city, the next town, especially when they meet Homer Stokes is the George Nelson is who I was thinking of, the bank robber.
Babyface
Nelson.
So when they meet Tommy, he tells them, oh, if you sing in this guy's can, he'll give you money. Which is like, what the fuck does that mean? And then when you find out that, oh, it's a radio station and you sing into it and he'll broadcast it throughout. And it is kind of the way this like movie plays with sort of like people's knowledge of technology and how they describe things. And right, like they've been in prison for who knows how long.
Yeah.
So it's kind of reminded me a little bit of Shawshank when the older guy gets out at the end and he's just like, there's fucking cars. I saw one car when I was a child before I went to prison, and like the world's fucking crazy now. So we don't know how long they've been in, but it can't be, they're younger. So
he kills himself, right?
yeah, he did. Yeah. You remember Shawshank.
I remember.
The cars drove him to it. So they go to this radio station and they break out in this song. And I think this song has sort of overshadowed the movie a little bit at this point.
So I actually watched a interview with George Clooney a couple weeks ago, and one of the reasons we're doing this movie is because it reminded me how I've always wanted to do this movie. But I watched an interview with George Clooney about him doing this song, and he is like, yeah, and when it hit number one on the Billboard 100, he's like, I didn't really like it because I don't really think of myself as a singer. And the fact that now my voice is that I didn't like it. And it did. It hit number one in the top Billboard 100s in the album soundtrack list for 20 weeks straight.
Yeah, it sold 5 million copies, 2 concert tours. It won the Country Music Awards Album of the Year and Single of the Year. It also won 5 Grammys. This is talking about the whole soundtrack.
It went like double platinum, triple gold. Yeah, it's insane.
The thing is, that's not George Clooney's voice, at least on the main song.
Right.
So I don't know why maybe you're like misquoting him a little bit, but
maybe he just mean like he doesn't like being connected to it because it's not his voice. Maybe that's what he meant.
Yeah, probably makes a little more sense given the facts of the situation. I don't know. This song will just like break out in my head like all the time for the past 20 years.
You're cursed.
It's such a catchy song. So I don't know. I do think that it is a little bit overshadowed the movie to the point where when you think back of it, it's like, this isn't the Odyssey movie. This is the, like, the Constant Sorrow movie. This is the Soggy, like, you think of this movie as the Soggy Bottom Boys.
Yeah.
Which that is, like, such a small plot point in this movie.
Could have also been a better name for the movie.
Soggy Bottom Boys. I think it was either Soggy Bottom or Soggy, like, that was the fake name for Licorice Pizza before the movie was called Licorice Pizza. It was,
that's pretty funny.
Soggy Bottom because of the waterbeds in the movie.
Oh. I thought, like, you never want a soggy bottom on a pizza.
There's no pizza in Licorice Pizza.
Well, there's no one saying, "Oh, brother, where art thou?" in the movie, "Oh, brother, where art thou?"
I'm sure the sheriff at one point, what if that is his brother related?
What?
So.
Oh, the sheriff and Everett. Also, naming your character Ulysses, but also, like, it works being both in the Odyssey and it's a southern ass name.
Well, they call him Ulysses, but they barely have him ever say it. He goes by Everett for the most part.
Right.
So also, one, I love Stephen Root as the blind radio station host. And two, after they sing and he's like, "Oh, I'm so impressed. You guys sign this paper, you get $10 each." And he's like, "All right, well, the other two who haven't spoken, they just have to sign with X's if that's okay." Which is like, why did he, was he going to feel the pen strokes and be like, "Oh, those are the same signatures."
Or just sign different names.
Yeah, like, it doesn't matter. He just makes up what Alistair and whatever. Like, I don't know. It's just a funny little bit. And then they run into the governor after
this. That's it.
Such a funny, like, through line of the movie. Like, the different, like, just, you, it almost doesn't connect until the end when it connects. But just, like, every, like, little bit, there's, like, a little scene to, like, break off from the real action to be like, "Dude, our campaign fucking sucks. What are we going to do? We're just getting our ass kicked over here."
It builds up this, I mean, you could get really political with what they're trying to say here, right? Being like, oh, the small-minded, like, the governor who's been the governor forever, you know, who wants to run again, he's looked upon as, like, the old age, the old ways we do things. It's this new age, this liberal kind of governor that we all want to kind of put our, you know, our votes into, find out that he's the head of the KKK. You could say a little bit about that right now, but, you know.
Well, I think it's just, yeah, change is not good. You don't want change. Is that what we're saying?
That is what I'm saying.
Is it? Okay, good. Yeah, I don't know that that's a good message. I think change is good sometimes. Yeah.
So you'd vote for the KKK leader?
No, I think there might be a third party we could go with, and just in this scenario.
There's not a third party now. I don't think there was a third party back then. Also, I'm standing up for the little man. It's a fucking great slogan when you have a little person on your campaign trail.
I just love his fucking son's idea. It's like, let's get a littler man.
It reminds me of that Greta Gerwig meme where it's like, oh man, she's directing Little Women and she can't possibly direct a movie about smaller women. And then the Barbie movie comes out.
Oh, I get it. So they camp out at night and they're saying, oh, the barn's too hot and we don't want to stay in there. And then the cops show up again and they say Tommy ran off at first, you know, first time seeing them. And it's because of the cop with the glasses? And, you know, the playing on the cop with the glasses being the devil, when he shows up, they fully pan up and down on him, showing the chain going to the dog, like, yeah, as they're saying, oh, Tommy ran off immediately.
Yeah.
So it's definitely is playing with that idea. And then we run into Babyface Nelson after this, which is a very fun little
jaunt. Dude, I love Babyface Nelson, and I love the callback at the end where he's getting, like, is he getting lynched? He's getting electric chaired. Electric chaired. Yeah. He's being taken to get electrocuted. And I love one of the background characters goes, "Damn cow killer." Like, that's the thing that people are pissed off about him.
You know, it's funny, and I don't know if this, maybe that was added in ADR as a fucking joke, but you know, in movies, they'll have the no animals were harmed in the making of this.
Yeah.
So PETA would not sign off on that because they're like, you fucking killed a cow. And so the Coen brothers had to prove to them that it was a digital cow that got hit by the car or and got shot, that, like, you know, no actual cows were harmed. And so I wonder if that was put in there, like, afterwards. It's just like a, yep, fucking cow killer. That's the worst thing you could be.
That'd be funny. I mean, the way that cow just stood still while being, like, riddled with bullets was pretty funny.
And then the other one, it got hit over, and then, but, like, it got hit by the car, but then, like, looked like it was still fine. Like, it, like, looked at the camera and almost, like, winked. After this, oh, and the funny thing about him being upset about being called Babyface, I thought was, like, hilarious.
My name is George Nelson.
George.
George.
The Soggy Bottom Boys are getting famous off of the song. There is literally a picture of them stealing a pie off a windowsill. And then Del Mar puts down money because he's like, you know, he's saved. Been saved.
Yeah.
And then there's just a traveling montage, them stealing a truck. And then we get to the sirens in the water, which is a very cool scene.
Why did Pete? What did he see? I rewinded to see if he could see the women in the water. I don't think you can see shit.
I think he heard because he's like, shut up so that he could hear.
Just going to run to any singing lass, huh?
Apparently the three sirens were in Maxim the year after this movie. They did a Maxim shoot.
Good.
So that's something I gotta research after this.
Yeah, we gotta dig a little bit more into that.
You know, I mean, for
research,
they want to know. You know what I'm saying? Like, obviously. And so they're getting drunk with them, and they all of a sudden pass out. And when they wake up, Pete is a frog.
Delmar is so stupid, but I gotta tell you what. I kind of thought that's where the movie was going.
You're like, oh, maybe he's right on this one?
Yep.
Man, look at that Googling. Alon right now is currently showing me the Maxim shoot on his phone. So I don't even have to do the research. There it is.
You're welcome, buddy.
It's
pretty good.
So they are now carrying around a toad that they think is their friend Pete. They go to a restaurant and they draw the attention of the Cyclops, who is played by John Goodman.
Now, this is like a hoity-toity, like country club almost sort of thing is what I'm thinking about. And it's like Del Mar doesn't have the suave or the decency to like kind of pull off that he belongs to eat at this place. I think they only have the money, right? Because Nelson just, that's another thing, is that Nelson gave them all of his money and then just kind of like walked off in a depressive state.
Man, you just went so many directions right there. I think John Goodman heard the money, right? I think that, you know, we talked earlier in the movie about George Clooney saying, oh, you know, when you lose a sense, your other senses can be heightened. And so, and this is Cyclops from the Odyssey, you know, had better hearing and better smell. He could smell Odysseus when he was trying to escape. And so, you know, later on in the clan meeting, he smells the
oh, that's fucking
the Dapper Dan on his head. That's how he knows it's there. And then this one, I think he literally hears the fucking paper touching. He's like, I'm gonna steal these guys' money. And it's just so, the fucking, like, one of the most disgusting characters. He's like, can you guys just pay for my food and we're going to go eat somewhere and then, you know, and then we'll, you know, we'll continue this conversation. And then, like, after he's finished eating, he's like, thank you for not talking to me while we eat. I find it to be vulgar. And just, what are we talking about? Just gets up, wiping his hands off, breaks a branch off, and you just, everyone, like, the audience knows what's happening, but our fucking idiot protagonists have no clue what's about to happen. And just fucking whacks him with this stick.
There's so much to unpack here, but I love Clooney's whole thing where he's like, the leader of the group, so he knows best on everything. It's like, I see you have the gift of the gab, fella. So do I. Like, he's so smitten by John Goodman's, like, good demeanor for, like, the first little bit. Even he breaks the fucking branch. He hits Delmar over the head with it. And Clooney's still like, what's happening here, buddy? Like, what's going on?
I love the way when he swings, and this is kind of timed perfectly in the movie, you know that they were like, have corn in your mouth so that when you get hit, you fucking spit all of it out at the camera, basically. And then he kills the fucking toad because it's not money.
Yeah, it's pretty sad.
Not a good look for the Cyclops, I'll tell you that much.
When the sirens knock them out and took John Turturro, because that's how we find out. So he doesn't get turned into a frog, but he gets taken in by the sirens to the cops, get rearrested. I guess they have a bounty on their heads, right? And the idea is that it's three women, so they can't carry all three men. So all three women carry one man each time. And before they come back for the other two, they've escaped. They did not get robbed at that point. They still had all of their money and all of their possessions at that point. So the sirens did not rob them. Only for them just to get completely robbed by John Goodman.
Yeah, that's how the cookie crumbles sometimes. I don't think the sirens kind of were like, we know that these are bad guys, so we'll turn them in for the reward. I guess maybe the police are getting the word out on these guys because they want them back. But they don't know that they have this money on them. And maybe you don't trust Pete to be holding the money.
Yeah.
So we then see that Pete is alive after the frog gets killed. And he's being whipped. And the guy with the black glasses is going to hang him. But then he says, God forgive me. And so in an act of mercy, he puts him back on the chain gang rather than killing him right there.
Because he sold him out of the treasure.
Now I wonder if... But the way it's displayed in that part, he hadn't sold him out yet, but he later on says he did.
I took it that he sold him out right then and there, and that's why he was put up back on the chain gang. I love when Delmar and Everett are in the back of the truck and they're driving past the chain gang and they see Pete, and Clooney's like, does Pete have a twin?
So, must be seeing things. Well, but my point is the movie doesn't really show us that, right? It doesn't show us that him giving them up. He's like, all right, let's hang him. And he's like, Lord, please forgive me. And then it sort of cuts. Now, maybe the devil guy is like, oh, Lord, please forgive me. He's asking for forgiveness because he's about to tell on his friends. Maybe that's what the movie is sort of saying later, because he says, please forgive me, to Delmar and Everett.
I read it as, I read it a bit different than you. I read it way more straightforward that he obviously gave it up, but I can't remember
exactly. You don't know that. But my point is, you don't know that in the moment. He doesn't give them up on camera. It just cuts to him being back on the chain gang.
Yeah, man, I'm just thinking of this differently. I don't know why, but yeah.
Okay, but it doesn't show us that. You're like, I'm just thinking of it differently. It's like, but it doesn't show that.
But I'm pretty sure it does. That's why I'm thinking. I specifically remember it doing it, but I could be wrong. I'm just saying that's not how I remember. It's not my truth.
You motherfucker. Yeah. So anyway, he's back on the chain gang, and then they go to a new town where George Clooney sees his daughters. I don't know what that was. This is fucking weird. And they say that his mama, his wife, ex-wife now, is remarrying tomorrow. And this guy's bona fide. I have no idea what that means.
I think that just means he's like, he has a job and he's like, like a taxpayer.
And then he finds out that his wife has been telling all their daughters that he got hit by a train. She's like, I have to do right by my girls, you know, because
Mama said you got hit by a train. I did not get hit by a train.
And then he gets his ass kicked by the fiance. And one of the fucking most famous lines of this movie, and stay out of the Woolworths.
It took me a second to realize that was Holly Hunter, because I don't think I've ever seen her that young in anything.
She's definitely been younger in things. They're just probably things you and I haven't seen. So they go to the movie and the prisoners are brought in. They're just brought in like halfway into this fucking movie. They don't even get to see the whole thing. It's just like whenever they made it there, the prison just stops the movie and says, all right, let's start it back up.
We thought you got turned into a toad.
Don't seek the treasure. It's an ambush.
That was definitely like another one of the most comedic parts of the movie, is the heavy whispering in the movie theater.
I thought Delmar was about to scream, like just scream it out. So they break Pete out, and then this reveal is probably like the greatest part of the movie, where he's like, I'm sorry, I told on you. He's like, man, don't worry about it. There wasn't a treasure anyway. He's like, what? I only had 2 weeks left. I was like, yeah, but my wife was getting married. Not, you know, I didn't have 2 weeks. He's like, they added 50 years to my sentence. He's like, listen, we were chained together. I don't know what you wanted me to do.
I was confused about that, because I understand George Clooney's rush to get there to stop the wedding of his ex-wife. But what was Pete's motivation to like
$400,000?
Yeah, but why did he have to leave now?
Because George Clooney told him he had to?
I guess.
And also, I mean, the story, and then it turned out to be true, was the flooding, right?
That's true too, yep. So that part was always true, and George Clooney knew that, I guess.
I don't know. That's a bit more fortuitous with everything else. And then they stumble onto a Klan rally, and as the audience, you can clearly tell that the gubernatorial candidate is the leader of the KKK in this local area.
I don't know. It came to a surprise to me when he pulled off his hood. And then the little guy pulled off his hood. I was like, whoa.
Okay, well, I guess it was obvious to some of us in the audience. And they see that Tommy is there, and they're like, we have to break him out. There's a couple, like, almost like, I don't even know if you can say this making fun of the KKK today, but like the, you know, there's some smarty pants out there that think we're descended from monkeys. And he's like, that's not my heritage. And then there's this other part where they say, hang the black guy. And all the people in the audience of the KKK are just like, hooray. Like, just like sort of the most half-hearted, like, yay.
Well, it's just kind of off that thing, right? Like, we did a movie like a couple months ago, The Black Klansman, where the KKK and their leaders aren't exactly depicted as the smartest, you know, crayons in the box. But on top of that is that we also have the infamous scene from Tarantino and Django Unchained with Jonah Hill. So I think it's just a very like common thing just to like make fun of this group.
No, yeah, I was talking about the lackadaisical nature of them like being happy about this. But I just, some of the lines in it are just things that, like, the way it was done, it was kind of interesting.
Maybe it was showing because it's coming to the end of that. Like the end of an era.
I don't even know what you mean right now. But I'm going to move on.
No, I just mean, like, the lackadaisical, like, energy of the other KKK members, maybe, like, as a group. Like,
I just think it was funny, man. I don't know. Why are you reading into it?
Look into the geopolitical climate of this. Okay,
was 1937 a downtime for the Klan?
I think it was
in Mississippi.
Yeah, I think it was teetering out.
Yeah, there. Yeah, until Samuel Jackson killed those boys and they rose again for a little bit, but then Jake Bergance, you know, stamped them out. And they take over the color guard, but as we said earlier, the Cyclops smells them, pull off the masks, and once again they said that these are black guys, I think, because they're covered, and throws the flag and he's like, don't let it fall, and John Goodman slaps his hands together and catches it in between his palms, only for then the cross to fall on him and him get his reward, which just leads to basically like the penultimate scene in the movie is the wedding of his wife that he's like stopping. And they start singing, and then they start singing the Soggy Bottom. And it's funny is, like the showmanship of George Clooney, his character in this movie, is he's talking to his wife, trying to win her back. And then they start singing Soggy Bottom. He's like, oh, this is my fuck, or, you know, whatever the song's actually called, Constant Sorrow. And he's like, this is my fucking song. He just like gets away from her and starts singing it.
I want to know where they got the fake beards from.
It's a good question. I mean, it seems like they had an inside guy.
Yeah, I also really like how the other governor comes in, crashes his own party. Like, these boys are criminals, and they're black, and they are against the Confederacy. And everyone is like, yeah, but they sing real well, so you're going to have to fucking get out of here. And
he's like, you know, they interrupted a lynch mob, and I'm part of a secret society. I don't have to tell you which one it is, you know. And then he says that black guy sold his soul to the devil, and everyone's just like, none of this makes sense. Boo! Just get out of here.
And then the governor, who's been the one who's trying to get reelected, who's like, oh, we don't have a gimmick, we don't have a good campaign. And it all comes to like this perfect ending, right? Where Waldrip, George Clooney's ex-wife's new husband, is the campaign manager for the racist guy who just got basically knocked out of the race. And so all of a sudden, he has no job. He denied being the campaign manager for the guy who, I guess, inevitably does win. He hires the Soggy Bottom Boys as, I don't know even if you're allowed to do that, but he does it as his campaign manager. And so Holly Hunter's like, ah, fuck it. I guess I'm going to go with the guy who's bona fide, especially since he got pardoned.
I mean, I think she originally probably broke up with him because he was in jail. You know, there's probably like one of the bigger issues is just, you know, she had to figure, they had seven daughters. She had to figure shit out.
Well, why'd she break up with her new husband? Because I guess he's the campaign manager of a racist.
No, because she went back to her husband.
But why?
Because she loves George Clooney.
Okay.
I think you can see that on her face throughout, that she's sort of like, you know, she's trying to deny his charm, and she's like, I have to do this for my daughters. And then, you know, when he's back and, you know, her other prospects have died out, she's like, all right, well, I'll go back to the guy I love.
I don't get the whole County of the Three and the Ring business.
I think it's just, you know, this is based off the Odyssey, right? So you know what an Odyssey is. And so it's just making the journey like a little bit harder. And she's a very persnickety woman who's like, I want my ring. And it's also just a funny ending when he, you know, he goes, he's almost killed. He gets what he thinks is the ring. And then he comes back. He's like, oh, that's my answering. He's like, well, there's nothing I can do now. It's fucking 9,000 hectares of water. She's like, I counted to three. Like, this is over. I want my ring. He's like, what the fuck do you mean? You want your ring? Like, I can't do it for you.
Maybe if it's in another drawer of that dresser, he could find it. But if it was under the mattress, that thing's long gone.
Did you see the water coming? Like, did you expect that when they were about to be, like, killed?
Yes and no. I kind of forgot that he made that passing statement before, but I feel like somewhere I've seen that scene before, so I kind of had it in the back of my head that I was like, okay, there's, like, some sort of flood. It reminded me of that scene in Evan Almighty.
I don't think I remember Evan Almighty. I was more of a Bruce guy.
I mean, I'm Bruce Almighty all the way. Hallelujah. But in Evan Almighty, he's like, oh, the flood's coming. The flood's coming. And he, like Noah, he builds an ark and there is no flood. And there's a little bit of rain. Everyone's like, oh, my God, the flood's coming. And then the rain stops. And I think it was John Goodman again, I believe, in Evan Almighty. But he sanctions a dam and he skips the safety, you know, whatever, for the dam. So that little bit of rain is just enough water to break the dam, because it's not a good well-built dam. They skip some safety, you know, procedures building it, and because of John Goodman passed the law, you know, whatever, the dam broke, flooded the whole thing. And that is my callback to Evan Almighty.
Yeah, you fucking kidding me right now? That you just did all that about Evan Almighty, a movie that we will never do.
Yes, on this podcast. The only reason I mentioned
it, unless you're doing a solo episode,
the which it might turn into now, but the only reason I did it was to do the callback from the flood, and John Goodman was the congressman in that movie.
All right, so you didn't see it coming. That's good to know. So the water saves them. They're apparently the only, even though they have like their hands tied behind their back, they're the only ones that survive, not any of the cops, the gravediggers, anybody else. And then, yeah, it ends with the wife saying, no, I want my ring. And he's like, what the fuck? Couple interesting fun facts about this. So George Clooney read the script, was like a little confused about the character. So his uncle, a tobacco farmer, lived in Kentucky. George Clooney originally from Kentucky. He sent the script to his uncle and had him read it and just record it so that he could sort of get the voice, get them, you know, get what he kind of wanted out of the movie. And then when doing the movie, the Coens were like, do you know that you omitted all the damns and hells that your character is supposed to say in the script? And it's because his uncle was a Baptist and just like didn't say them when he was recording it, just cut them out.
That's so funny.
Yeah. Another kind of interesting thing.
So funny because Clooney's character is like anti-religious. That's hilarious.
So cinematographer Roger Deakins on this, apparently the movie.
Wait, Roger Deakins did this movie?
Yeah.
Whoa.
And apparently the movie, they had to like color correct it in post because they said it looked so fucking green when they shot it and they wanted this sort of dusty brown look.
I heard about it too.
So Tim Blake Nelson, I think, was a neighbor to one of the Coens when they sent the script to him and they were like, had never even seen him act. A movie that I was sort of not like big to me, but I watched and was like, I don't know, very affected by as like a kid was the movie 2001 movie O, which is a retelling of Othello. And it is directed by Tim Blake Nelson, who apparently edited that movie like at night while he was shooting Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Okay.
And it's called O. Coincidences, man. Mind blowing.
I know Tim Blake Nelson because he was Mom in the movie Holes with Shia LaBeouf.
The other thing that so the guy that plays the sheriff is Daniel Von Bargen. The only other thing, who passed away, I guess, in 2015. The only other thing I've ever seen him in is Malcolm in the Middle. He's like the commandant of the older brother at his military school. He's like the head of that military school.
He's the older brother?
He's not the older brother. He's like the older brother, the guy that runs the military school that the older brother goes to.
Oh, okay.
It's the only thing I've ever seen him in my life besides this movie.
I just had a real rude awakening. How old I am, but also how young I am, is that Tim Blake Nelson was in Holes, and that movie came out in 2003, and this movie came out in 2000. But to me, because I saw Holes first, it's an older movie. I just had a trippy moment.
Yeah, that's not how time works at all.
No?
So, I don't even think we did like the overall, I don't think we did what our thoughts were on this movie. Did you like this movie?
I did. I felt a little bit unconnected to this film just because it was so like act one, act two, act three. And it was kind of hard for me to get into it and like make a connection with these characters. But the ending wrapped up so nicely. And I don't know. I love Coen Brother movies. I mean, my favorite movie ever is a Coen Brothers movie. It's Inside Llewyn Davis. And it's just like, I like their acting style. I like their direction. And so you're on mute. I can't hear you.
No, I didn't say anything. You like their acting style?
The way they direct their actors. I'm sorry. I need to clarify that for you, little baby. But no, I do. I really like this movie. Do you like this movie?
I do.
Yeah.
I do like it, but after seeing so many of their other movies, I think I like most of them more, like Inside Llewyn Davis, No Country, even Burn After Reading.
How about Miller's Crossing is a movie we did last year?
that those are kind of close to me. Miller's Crossing is like a good movie, but is very so like kind of stuck in its time, right?
It's dense. It's a dense movie.
But just like the acting, the directing, the look of it is so early 90s, late 80s to me, which is like a fucking bugaboo for me.
Okay.
But I still think it's really great. And that one is a kind of a perfect line of like a Coen Brothers movie that is like mixes kind of the comedy with like being very starkly serious.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like, I really like this movie. I think just because of how much more I like some of their other ones that like in their rankings, the Coen rankings, this one is slipping, but not to do with its quality, but to just do the quality of everything else.
I'm looking forward to doing more Coen Brother movies because I'm looking at the list now and there's just a ton that some I've never even heard of, some I heard of but didn't know it was them, and then some that have been on my list to watch for a while, just never got around to it. But I will say, and I guess like in the pure sense of a Coen Brothers movie, Fargo is still one of my top Coen Brother films.
Yeah, I would agree.
And this is strange, but I have never... I like The Big Lebowski, but I know people who fucking love The Big Lebowski, but I've just never been one of those people.
I like it a lot. I mean, it's got, you know, it's got the PSH in it, which is always a plus for me. I don't know. I think we just have to do more of these and then just do a comprehensive ranking where we yell at each other for an hour.
I like that. I like that idea. I'm all for it.
Well, thanks for listening to another episode of I Finally Watched. This is David.
And this is Alon. And I finally watched Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?